you have there is, in fact, not a new paper. It's a paper that I wrote several years ago for a conference in Budapest that I was going to attend on Agnes's work. But at the last minute, I wasn't able to make it, and so the paper was never presented. And so I thought it might be worthwhile to give it an audience for once. But before I start to read it, I just wanted to say a few words by way of introduction. Philosophy is cultural expression, it's life expression, and I guess I thought it might be worthwhile to just understand a little bit where this particular paper's coming from. Yesterday at lunch, we were having a discussion about the ages of man and whether it was good to be young or whether age had some beauties of its own, and both Agnes and I were arguing that to get old is not so bad, that it has some beauties of its own and worthwhile. And I was reminded of the fact that I think Plato thought that to be a philosopher guardian, you had to reach the age of, was it 50 or 55?
You have to be 30 to start studying.
Yes, but to be fully qualified, you have to be something like 55, yes. Well, I'm not quite there yet, but I'm close, you see. And so I have a certain sense of almost having attained the sort of wisdom that one needs to be a philosopher. But at the same time, I've always thought that the appropriate attitude of the philosopher is that of the beginner, somebody who is always prepared to start again and to sort of think through their worldview and their problems again and again. And there's many philosophers who have been like that. But so, if it's the case that to be a philosopher you have to go through this long period of training, sort of many years to get to sort of 50-odd, it is really very helpful, I think, to have people to assist you. Philosophy is very much a discipline where the school, the philosophical school, and also the relationship between master and disciple, master and student, have always been very, very significant. And I must say that in my own philosophical career, I've been very, very lucky. I've had actual master, a person, a member of the Budapest School, who came to Australia in 1978. He was a man called George Marcus, and he has, in a sense, been my sort of representation of sort of philosophy in the flesh. Somebody who I've gone to his classes, known him well. And I've certainly learned a great deal from the history of philosophy from him, more than I can say. But I've had not only George, I spent a great deal of, particularly in the 1990s, under the tutelage of Agnes Heller, another member of the Budapest School, and although I haven't had as much physical contact with Agnes, because we've met from time to time, she's come to Australia, she used to be there, But basically, my relationship with her has been very much a spiritual one. And sometimes I felt myself to be a little bit like Hans Castle in The Magic Mountain, you know, where he's caught between Settembrì, I think it is, and sort of NAFTA, and these two great ideological figures, in a sense, masters, are in a sense contesting for his soul. Now, I wouldn't see Agnes and George Marcus as quite as ideologically opposed as Settembrì and NAFTA. But at the same time, sometimes members of a family can also have their internal squabbles, and I'm sure that George and Agnes have also had their internal squabbles, philosophically speaking. They're of course great friends. But I make the point that Agnes talks about great philosophers as providing trampolines. You know, you get on a trampoline, you know, those things that, you know, you jump and allows you to jump much higher than you otherwise would. Now, I think certainly in my case, it's helped me to jump much higher than I otherwise would, being in such a close physical and spiritual contact to those two people. Now, that I think will give you some sort of background to what I'm about to say. Okay, this paper is called Between the Normative and the Empirical, Heller on the Antinomies of Culture. Now, over 150 years ago, Karl Marx forcefully expressed his discontent with the whole enterprise of philosophy. For this prospective revolutionary, the fundamental problem with philosophy was its practical importance. Caught between simply reproducing the world as it exists, or opposing to that world a merely subjective utopia that possessed no imminent power of realisation, philosophy lacked the capacity to generate the change that the young Marx believed was required. We all know where this critique led him, and the less than satisfactory results that ensued. His new enterprise that united theory and praxis, the project of synthesizing theoretical knowledge with critical historical analysis, was beset with the inherent danger not just of attempting to anticipate the always unpredictable future, but also of ascribing to that anticipation an epistemological privilege that was open to political abuse. Now, while it's probably fair to say that the hard lessons of Marx's misadventure have been theoretically absorbed, it is clearly not the case that the philosophical dilemma that instigated them has disappeared. Those who shared Marx's frustrations but learned his lessons had to retreat to philosophy and construct their home somewhere in the dangerous no-man's land between fact and norm, relying more or less on one or the other, but always attempting to keep a grip on both. The debate over what philosophy can do, what is its limits, how far it can or should stray from the empirical reality of the world it hopes to reflect, express, influence, or even change, goes on unabated. All contemporary philosophers must negotiate the dilemma left to those after Marx and find their own equilibrium of commitment somewhere between the competing dynamic demands of the empirical and the normative. Now, in rehearsing these well-known facts, I ask your indulgence not to reconsider the issues involved in all their magnitude, their complexity and generality, but to see how the strain of existential commitment between the empirical and the normative works itself out philosophically in a very particular case. In the following, I want to examine carefully Agnes Heller's account of the antinomies of modern culture in her recent comprehensive presentation of her theory of modernity, there is a theory of modernity, Blackwell 1999. Of course, when I wrote the paper, it was more recent than it is now. As perhaps the most well-known student of the great Hungarian Marxist George Lukács, whose work most potently expressed the impasse involved in the revolutionary theory, the revolutionary version of political theory, Heller's lineage to this constellation of issues is hardly surprising. Although she explicitly abandoned even her reformist humanist Marxism in the mid-70s, her desire to both preserve the social relevance of her own speculations and to employ them in the cause of anthropological radicalism is one of the most constant impulses of her work. While in the last 20 years her philosophy has evolved from post-Marxist radicalism to reflective postmodernism, or she has called reflective postmodernism, we will see that this link and tension between reflection on the contingent flow of historical experience and the will to utopia remains essential to her thinking. Now, the basic framework for Heller's analysis and diagnosis of modern culture is taken over from the theory of culture that was developed by Jorgi Marcus. The key text is his 1997 paper entitled The Antinomies of Culture. Now, from our perspective, this is a fortuitous choice. He both shares her philosophical commitment to social relevance, but his adoption of a radical historicising approach to the problem of culture makes a striking contrast to the integral utopianism of hers. Heller openly acknowledges her heavy reliance on her old friend and fellow Budapest Schuler, but she is equally forthright in indicating that her employment of his categories is, as I say, quite free and highly selective. A careful reconstruction of the way in which she appropriates his framework brings into especially clear focus the demands of the utopian dimension of her own thinking. The following reconstruction sets itself several tasks: to explain the main features of Heller's selective reading, to indicate the rationale that drives her own theoretical ingenuity, and to point to some weaknesses, or what I see as some weaknesses, in her normative concept of culture, and to show how they are intimately related to the utopian dimension of Heller's philosophical personality. So the first part of the paper is the anthropological and normative concepts of culture. Now, Marcus outlines two concepts of culture: the empirical, anthropological concept of culture as a human universal, and the normative concept of high culture. His argument is to show that both of these understandings of culture are beset with irresolvable antinomies. Culture, in this first empirical sense, has both a universal and a differentiating meaning. In the first, it connotes the general attribute or generic realm that all humans share and in which they necessarily participate. The latter, that is the differentiated meaning, connotes that complex of characteristics which unifies a particular social unit and distinguishes it from all others. Now, while this distinction seems clear enough, difficulties soon emerge. Theoretical efforts to empirically identify those cultural universals typically arrive at the rather paradoxical result that nature is identified as the only sure and legitimate ground of cultural invariance. The differential meaning suffers a similar quixotic fate. It turns out to be little more than an idealist construct. The particularising use of the concept of culture runs up against the fact that every significant social unit is constituted from a set of distinct and often opposed socio-cultural positions and roles. Thus, the moment of macro-cultural identity turns out to be little more than a theoretical hypostasisation. Now, our journey into antinomy does not cease when we move beyond the general anthropological to the narrow concept of high culture. Marcus finds here another veil of illusions. The concept of high culture designates a specific set of social practices, primarily the arts and sciences, that generally regarded as autonomous and valuable in themselves. The concept of high culture was invented in response to the decline of religion and the destruction of the traditional concept of nature as a cosmos. High culture was conceived as a resource for making good the resulting normative deficit. Humans can now declare themselves as masters of the universe. In both external activity and knowledge, they will be the makers, whose self-understanding is consummated in a whole system of symbolic meanings, culture through which they determine their ends and interpret their activity. This concept of high culture and its foundational aspirations is also linked to the increasing detachment and autonomy of these specific social practices from the everyday, as Agnes has been talking about, in the sense this represents her distinction between objectivation in itself and objectivation for itself. What George is talking about here as high culture is this domain of objectification for itself. It is therefore understandable that the concept of high culture is conceptually interrelated to its opposite, the inferior substitute low or mass culture. The elevation of high culture to the heights of human aspiration only makes sense in relationship to an opposite mass or popular culture that is organically attached to the interests and to the perspective of the unenlightened people. In Marcus's narrative, this opposition would have remained latent and fixed in the pre-modern segregation of states and human activities had it not been for commodification. Both high and low are brought to the market and they're set into competitive opposition. The result of that competition is the performative rejection of the claims of high culture to be the bearer of universal significance and validity. This competitive unmasking has its corollary in the cultural wars that lead to the progressive erosion of the substantive values of autonomous high culture. Even the claims of modern science to access a certain path to the discovery of objective truth is today disputed. Is not the so-identified truth nothing more than what is pragmatically serviceable for the general domination of existing powers, whether this be in the scientific community or in society at large? Similarly, the promise of modern art to create new works of beauty seems elusive and without content. On inspection, the resulting aesthetic quality turns out to be little more than a means of renovating the old social distinctions in new and more subtle ways. Now, this account of the antinomies of culture forms the basis and the inspiration for Agnes Heller's analysis of modern culture. Yet, as I've foreshadowed, Heller's reading is both free and selective, and this is quite intentional. So we now move on to the second section, Heller's antinomies of culture. Heller's version of the antinomy of the anthropological concept of culture is focused on the bipolar distinction, universality, difference. The universality claim of the anthropological concept rests on an appeal to the norm of equal recognition. However, the claim that each way of life is unique does not mean that each is of equal worth. While whole ways of life are incommensurable, this does not mean that we cannot compare partial aspects. The universal claim of the empirical concept may represent a leap of the imagination insofar as it eliminates the denigration of the other as barbarian. However, asserted dogmatically, it prohibits discussion of the comparative cultural worth of particular aspects of culture. As its most extreme, the upshot of modernity's self-reflexivity and capacity to relativize its own achievements is the resurgence of a natural ethnocentricism, with modernity being disarmed by its own relativist convictions and authoritarian regimes trumpeting their suppression of human rights as a blow for cultural autonomy. Now, Heller's account of the antinomies of high culture is much closer to Marcus's reading. However, she unfolds the antinomies of high culture from the concept of taste. Initially, Case was the property of social states, and it was not something that was acquirable. However, once enjoyment and refinement could be acquired, taste is now actualized as something that's mobile and changing. In our time, this dialectic of taste comes to question the relevance of the distinction between high and low altogether. Democratization has placed the question of cultural elitism permanently on the political agenda, and also sort of the cultural agenda. However, the proposition that everyone's taste counts ultimately points to the annihilation of cultural standards and the collapse of the very idea of high culture and its custodial cultural elite. Yet the mere logic of substantive democracy is not the end of the story. Even in our time, pervasive postmodern scepticism questioning the cultural standards has not led to the death of cultural elitism. The authority of the cultural elite has persisted, despite the fact that it has been divested of the theoretical ground on which it once stood. In contemporary culture, it is certainly true that the market and its quantitative logic has a louder voice than ever before. Yet despite this, the opinion of cultural authority still carries more weight than the proverbial man in the street. Factions within this elite may be most responsible for the destruction of the idea of objective standards. However, this persisting authority only goes to show that the attempt to destroy the concept of high culture is untenable. Those pronouncing the death sentence on high culture are already its beneficiary and the bearer of its function. So for Heller, there was no way to resolve the paradox flowing from this notion of high culture. She does offer some interesting avoidance strategies, but I shall pass over these to concentrate on her main innovation. And you can see I've got a long footnote talking about some of these interesting avoidance strategies that you can have a look at. So the third section of the paper is the utopia of cultural conversation. The most radical innovation in Heller's reconstruction is her introduction of a third concept of culture. It is the means whereby the paradoxes of modernity can be, at least theoretically, overcome. Like the normative and the empirical concepts of culture, this additional concept of culture is also a universal. Heller calls this an operative concept, because it provides equal opportunity for participation in culture. Cultural discourse is a conversation. This has no aim other than itself. It presupposes neither social nor professional qualifications, only a delight in dialogue. Enthusiastic individuals who value conversation and perfect cultivation. However, it does have historical preconditions. These are equivalent to the historical enlightenment that saw discourse become deeply embedded in everyday life and assume the function of critique. This made critique the main carrier of the dynamics of modernity. And of course, this is one of the fundamental differences that Agnes wants to point to about the characteristic of modernity. In modernity, critique has, in a sense, been domesticated, it's become part of everyday life, whereas in pre-modern societies this was not so much the case. Now, while cultural discourse is an essentially unruly activity, it is nevertheless constrained by definitive procedural rules. These constitute a normative moment exemplified in the single idea of disinterest. The ethics of discourse requires the suspension of interests, the making of our prejudices explicit, and others have to be listened to sympathetically, their sincerity taken at face value. Now, these conditions constitute a sort of moral code of discourse that instantiates the norm of equal opportunity. Yet the differential contribution by discussants does not infringe this norm. Because the realm of cultural conversation is a domain of suspended interests, a culturally constructed free space, no harmful consequences flow from unequal real participation. So insofar as it avoids bipolarism, commercialization, and commodification, cultural discourse blunts the paradoxes arising from the other concepts of culture. Take, for example, the value that is for Heller the leading value idea of modernity. Whereas modern freedom is a paradoxical foundational value that does not culturally ground modernity because it does not provide certainty or self-evidence. Free discussion, unconstrained by power or interests, produces a weak ethos that simply does not require foundation. Things are similar when we turn to the dialectic of taste that ultimately threatens to undermine the very concept of high culture. As mentioned, cultural discourse manages to stay afloat, suspended only by its weak ethos of unconstrained conversation. At a time when truth has been eroded to the subjective and historical without any absolute imprimatur, a conversational judgment of taste can still claim universality despite contestation. Heller finds in Kantian judgment of taste a model that is generalizable to all cultural discourse. The result is a utopian artifice of social sociability where all interests, pragmatic, theoretical and practical, are suspended for the sake of the dynamic alone, as its own end. Now, this does not mean that such discussion can be valid and free, but only that interests and prejudices, to the extent known, should be openly declared. While this is another quarantined world, many things flow indirectly from cultural discussion. Certainties are undermined, beliefs are queried and tested, as well as being enthusiastically embraced. Heller is aware that such immunity does have a downside. These same conversations can be frivolous and irresponsible, but she is happy to risk these defamations for the sake of such overriding benefits that I've noted above. So Heller is also reluctant to simply confine this utopia to the realm of the virtual. Cultural discourse for her is not an impotent ideal, but a fiction that is shared around the dinner table and amongst friends. This reluctance deserves some comment. In her reflective postmodern mood, she has resolutely resisted the sirens of the Hegelian dialectic of reality and actuality. This is most clearly expressed in her final repudiation of the Marxian philosophy of history. Yet she freely admits that she was always attracted to a philosophy where everything clicks. And when her thought turns to the sphere of cultural discourse, perhaps she momentarily succumbs to this seductive melody. Discourse now becomes an actualized utopia, the coalescence of virtuality and actuality. Her desire for the empirical confirmation of her utopian hopes is perfectly understandable. But when this hope struggles empirically to penetrate beyond the intimate sphere and finds its actuality reduced to conversation over the dinner table and amongst friends, then Heller's claim for the coalescence between the virtual and the actual seems, at least to me, to stretch things too far. This could just as easily, could just as recently, be described as a divorce, the divorce between reality and actuality. So the conversations of private space are not convincing confirmation of the health or even the viability of modern cultural discourse. Now, before going on to look more closely at this understanding of cultural discourse, to consider its presuppositions and its rationale, I want to return momentarily to Marcus. He not only describes the so-called antinomies of culture, but also unfolds their function and their socio-cultural significance within a more comprehensive interpretation of modern culture. In the light of this background, we will be in a better position to probe the theoretical motives and consequences of Heller's innovative third concept of culture as cultural discourse. And so I've titled the fourth section, which is on Marcus's more elaborate theory, The Paradoxical Functional Unity of Modern Culture. Now, the primary theoretical motive behind Marcus's reconstruction of the antinomies of culture is an attempt to explain the logic of modern cultural dynamics as a whole. This involves an appreciation of the lauded autonomy of modern culture. In an earlier pre-modern period, religion functioned primarily to articulate a complex ideational symbolic system that simultaneously orientated and directly regulated the conduct of individuals by providing an overarching shared meaning and obligatory norms for their conduct. This function loses its meaningfulness when society comes to look like a vast causal instrumental complex of patterned interactions, functionally coordinated subsystems conforming to their own logic, and the everyday activities of the vast majority are highly technical and bereft of any socially shared and experientially transparent meaning. No longer able to fulfil this cultural role of providing abiding common standard and orientation, religion is privatised. The concept of high culture now steps in to make up for this normative deficit. High culture provides a dynamic reservoir of meanings from which modern individuals are able to draw in establishing their own identities and solidarities. Modern individuality is conceived as formed by personal choices. Modern individuals are makers who not only form the external artifice, but also sovereignly create the meaning of their own lives. You know, this is Agassiz's idea, which is already referred to, that you know, man is born free. He's born free, and in a sense, the modern individual is there to create their own fate, their own meaning. In accordance with this model, the high and more broadly institutionalised culture of modernity objectively plays a larger role than ever before in organising the everyday, but it can no longer be viewed as the highest expression or conceptual systematisation of the latter. This explains its partially ideological character. The grand illusion of self-creation masks the extent to which the spectrum of life's possibilities is fundamentally constrained by the individual's location in the great functional institutional subsystems that encompass them. However, this tension is evident in the perpetual incongruence between the two. This incongruence is the source of the perennial claims of cultural deficiency of modernity. For Marcus, this diagnosis of loss of meaning allows two interpretations. The first assumes the shape of disenchantment, the triumph of truncated rationality that reduces everything to the status of mere means and leaves the individual at the mercy of this self-created but uncontrolled second nature. The alternative reading views the problem as not too little rationality but too much. It dwells nostalgically on spontaneous cultural unity of the past and wills the resurrection of the security and warmth of the particular organic community by means of a new mythology or reinvestment in fabrication of tradition. Now, these diagnostic differences issue in fundamentally opposed ideologies, projects, and practical attitudes. Thus, we find evolutionism opposed to cultural relativism, cosmopolitanism opposed to primitivism or various shades of ethnic and cultural nationalism, and general modernisation versus programmes for cultural separatism. The dispute between the two diagnostic programmes of Enlightenment and Romanticism underlines the whole history of cultural modernity. What is most distinctive about the Marcus reading of this endless struggle flows from his condition that neither program can hope to succeed in its own exclusive terms. He finds the enduring but also paradoxical unity of modern culture to consist in the active competition for cultural supremacy between these two polar opposites. This is only possible because the two most significant and largely independent domains of this culture, science and arts, are constituted both categorically and institutionally as the polar opposites of each other. Enlightenment stands behind the methods and practices of the sciences, understood as an embodiment of rational critical thinking, while Romanticism puts its faith in the enormous creative power of the arts as the cultural vehicle and the model for the resurrection of culture's life-orientated role. However, these paradigmatic forms of meaning creation are culturally constituted as complementary. Each actually functions as a form of compensation for the threatening one-dimensionality of the dominant principle of the other. This fundamental oppositional dualism is not some incidental cultural quirk, but it reflects and expresses the essentially antinomical nature of modernity itself. Under modern conditions, the scientific and aesthetic attitude have become universalized and are no longer confined to a pre-established domain. Anything and everything can, in principle, become their object, yet their requirements and criteria of validity exclude each other and lead to inevitable conflict. Yet it is precisely this seesaw struggle that is the mechanism by which the cultural structure of modernity is reproduced and modernity achieves as much cultural integration as it is able. Now, this being the case, it is understandable that Marcus views the aspirations that have motivated the ceaseless struggle between these ideological combatants as illusory. In fact, he speaks of double illusions. Not only was this critique predominantly expressed in terms of opposed and equally exclusive totalizing ideologies, these also nourish exaggerated ideas about their own social power and effectiveness. However, he is reluctant to reproduce such illusions by himself by engaging in unqualified total critique. It is certainly true that all recent attempts to practically realise these programs, either in Enlightenment or of Romanticism in a radical way, have resulted in appalling social and human tragedies. While the criminality of these radical attempts is beyond question, Marcus still wants to underline the positive contribution made by these illusions. It was primarily through the prism of these totalizing ideologies that culture supplemented its compensatory function with a critical one. Critique not only bewailed the apparent deficiencies of modern culture, but also directed its animus at existing social arrangements that denied to culture the possibility of playing its ascribed role, its ascribed leading life-orientating role. More than mere compensatory safety valve that allowed individuals to live with the fundamental structural contradictions of modernity, it also served as a modest corrective to their spontaneous tendencies. Not only does the endless contest of Enlightenment and Romanticism sustain the overall dynamics of modernity, more specifically, the universalizing radicalism of these critiques makes its own special contribution. It drew attention to real ills and dysfunctionalities of modern development and supplied ideal resources from which individuals could draw in the process of mobilisation to assert their own autonomy and solidarity against the self-steering functional subsystems of modern society. It provided ideas that allowed particular grievances to be represented as matters of common concern. Now, some startling theoretical and diagnostic conclusions flow from Marcus's reconstruction of the paradoxical functional unity of modern culture. It is clear that in his view, there is no attractive and viable way beyond the antinomies of modernity. Its antagonist of pluralism is the basic source of modern dynamism. All attempts to overcome these antinomies lead not to the overcoming of contradictions of modernity, but to the abandonment of modernity itself. The exclusive domination of either pole, that is, of either Enlightenment or Romanticism, erodes the equilibrium of a dynamic society that is committed to balancing contending imminent forces. In the light of these conclusions, we must now return to Heller and review the meaning of her claim that her third operative concept of culture as cultural discourse is a way of overcoming the antinomies at the heart of the modern concept of culture. Okay, now the next session, our section is called The Threat of Omnivorous Culture. Now, it should be remembered that Heller attributes universality to each of the concepts of culture, but only in a very definite sense. The empirical concept of culture is universal in the most obvious sense that it encompasses everything. High culture is universal in the sense of setting the standard, and cultural discourse is also universal because it provides equal opportunity. As we have seen, this latter universality of cultural discourse is especially crucial to Heller's account. For her, culture is a source of spiritual sustenance. While it is possible to live without cultural discourse, it is not possible to live the good modern life without it. A vital component of the latter is a high living that results from the suspension of everyday routine and the surrender to self-transcendence in the form of the absolute, in the shape of sensuously dense and meaningful cultural works. By selectively processing spiritual nourishment, the dominant cultural institutions create the reservoir of meaning that sustains modern lives. However, Heller sees a threat to this cultural function with the emergence of an omnivorous culture. This latter is a consequence of the multiple dynamics of modernity. Its cultural moment is the threat of the delegitimization of the cultural authority and the increasing dominance of the market. This leads to the homogenization of cultural products and the challenge to all qualitative distinctions. The result is a hermeneutic democracy of all texts. On the fundamental questions of who is selecting and which texts are selected, omnivorous culture answers with the smallest board. With the demise of cultural authority, the market determines the menu. This frenzy of interpretation is ably assisted by the modern imaginations, that is, the historical imagination and the technical imagination, that are only too willing to scour alien traditions and to rave the past and future in order to feed the ceaseless appetite for innovation and for new spiritual food. As Heller sees it, the omnivorous tendencies of modern culture engender prospective crisis. First, the hermeneutic feast leads to inklings of cultural exhaustion. This is already manifest in many features of modern culture. Take, for example, the modest expectations that are placed on modern art. Modern works are no longer required to be creations of fantasy, but merely indeterminate objects for the precipitation of the private imagination. Originality gives way to the extraction of personal meaning. But this is not all. Even more severe is the fragmentation of cultural discourse that results from cultural rationalisation and professionalisation. In an environment of increasingly autonomous culture and professional specialisation, the circle of participants in cultural discourse is reduced to those who interpret to make a living. As a result, cultural discourse becomes fragmented into insular, contingent, and fluid mini-discourses. For Heller, the contemporary cultural milieu represents a new phase beyond avant-gardism, where there is not only no community of interpreters to legislate standards, where the shared, dense cultural experience that once scorched a kind of common home simultaneously familiar, evocative, and novel is fast receding. The disappearance of cultural community leaves the individual interpreter as the sole mediator. In a cultural world reduced to individual mediation, the paradigms of language and hermeneutics become historically obsolete. There are no representative cultural horizons to clash, and the individual is constantly changing cultural languages. The power of interpretation increasingly now lies in the hands of the individual speaker and interpreter. He, she is finally in a position to convey her own unique perspective in her own ineffable way. However, this is only the power of the naked eye. Because this meaning is ever changing, shifting with every mood and mutation, it lacks authority and has no real message. Bereft of stability and authority, the naked subject is poorly equipped to assume the major role in cultural selection. Whereas the modern quest for political freedom is always constrained by the common theme, the re publica, the modern thirst for meaning threatens to remain unquenched because the directionless meanderings of the indeterminate subject fail to provide sufficient spiritual sustenance. It was not hard to see where Heller's concept of cultural discourse fits into this picture. Where the notion of cultural community seems to be in terminal decline, when the role of the cultural elite is under challenge, and cultural discourse is fragmented into multiple specialist mini-discourses, then Heller's actual utopia provides a normative measure that, in setting aside the constraints of modern functionality in the market, allows us to reanimate the original aspirations of cultural communication and to gauge its contemporary crisis. Moreover, we have seen that Heller is also reluctant to confine her model of cultural discourse to just subjective fancy or regulative idea. Clinging to a dialectical moment, she simultaneously views this actual utopia as tantalisingly close as our friendly conversations, yet sufficiently normative to do critical service. Okay, the final section is called Options and Choices, Immanent and Utopian, and here we'll sort of come back to my initial starting point. Now, it's relatively easy to question both Heller's diagnosis and the role the concept of cultural discourse plays in her theoretical solution. While no one can doubt the corrosive impact of the market and the problems that are generated by the increasing autonomy of culture, the omnivorous culture thesis tends to totalise these trends in an exaggerated way. On an empirical level, we might, along with the postmodernists, applaud the so-called fragmentation of cultural dialogue into mini discourses, not as a restriction, but as a differentiation that allows for the admission of many new, previously unheard voices that both enrich and problematise the dominant culture. Obviously, the mere existence of a spectrum of many discourses does not itself infringe Heller's model of cultural discourse. This would be so only if the many discourses signified the cessation of cultural dialogue in her equal opportunity sense. However, it could just as easily be argued that the phenomena of many discourses exemplifies a more sophisticated system of cultural filtration. One that is more in keeping with a complex modern society composed of an ensemble of semi-autonomous subsystems. In such a society, functional subsystems are essential. In the cultural domain, they ensure the flexibility that allows cultural material to be selected and prioritised for specific audiences. There are also tensions in Heller's diagnosis. While she seems to view the contemporary scene as in the throes of qualitative rupture, where only the market reigns and cultural elites are under threat, she also insists that postmodern authors are still able to trade on their own authority, and that is a classics that they interpret. But if the latter is true, then the former must be too simplistic. Now, for some time now, Heller has evoked the pendulum as her favourite metaphor for the fragile equilibrium of modernity. This is the so-called pendulum of modernity. Modernity has a dynamic that sort of swings like a pendulum. Yet on the question of culture, she anticipates a looming crisis. Clearly this cultural diagnosis sits oddly with her more comprehensive theory of modernity. This latter suggests that functionality plays an increasing role in the dynamics of modernity. If the heart of modernity is, as she insists in the theory of modernity, the logic of allocation, it stands to reason that functional principles increasingly permeate all modern institutional systems, including those of culture. However, amongst other things, the notion of cultural discourse was initially conceived as a transfunctional antidote to the excesses of functionality. The problem with the colonisation of functionality into the cultural domain is that it violates the normative assumptions of Heller's notion of cultural discourse. It is hard to reconcile this normative idea of unconstrained, disinterested, open-ended dialogue with a functionalism that is a direct bearer of interests. Now, Heller clearly views the disappearance of the connoisseur and the modern trend towards institutionalization and paid cultural elites as a sign of the threat to the possibility and the integrity of real cultural discourse. While there can be little doubt that increasing cultural autonomy and commercial pressure impacts on cultural discourse in many ways, the empirical evidence seems to be at least contradictory. Surveys suggest that markets have increased and not reduced the audience for high culture. Cultural institutions still uphold the demand for excellence, even if the criteria for it are hotly contested. And even on Heller's own reading, even postmodern critics still claim the authority to judge it. So far, we have at best a disagreement about the weight to be given to certain contemporary trends in the diagnosis of cultural modernity. Heller has marshalled her normative utopia of cultural discourse against what she sees as the most culturally debilitating of these tendencies. The negative consequence of her strategy is easily identified. The distance between her normative model and the dynamics of culture seems to render her vision even more utopian. Knowing that Heller has always ascribed a real utopian vocation to the philosopher, this will not disturb her too much. But it does all the same remain in an awkward tension with her residual Hegelian desire, already noted, that this utopia be not only virtual, but also actual. At this point, it may be appropriate to turn to my opening remarks about the dilemma that has faced all philosophers after Marx. We have seen that in Heller's theory of culture, this issue is resolved in favour of normative priority, with her commitment to change expressed in the hope that her utopia still has some grounds in actuality. Contrast to this, Marcus's quite different response. Giving priority to the Hegelian historicising moment, he abandons utopia in favour of a careful empirically detailed reconstruction of the actual pragmatics of modern cultural institutions. As we have seen, he seeks neither practical nor theoretical solution to the antinomies of modern culture. This is because the ideological poles of modern culture form a paradoxical functional unity that permits this culture both to express and to negotiate its most extreme tendencies. As a consequence, Marcus feels no need for a third normative concept of cultural discourse to relieve these antinomies. To be clear, this is not because we should relinquish normative requirements in the assessment of modern culture. Rather, in true Hegelian immanentist fashion, he maintains that this culture already has its own normative requirements built into its cultural pragmatics. This normative dimension of culture exists not in any personal cultural utopia, but is already immanent to the specific relations that exist in the various major domains of cultural activity. Marcus has in mind here the cultural relations configured around author, work, and audience. However, he cautions that this normative aspect of culture does not produce constitutive norms that would prescribe the actual character of practices and the effective evaluative evaluative criteria of their results, but only regulative principles that orientate an adequate understanding of them in terms of both reception and production. The appropriate model for discourse cannot be determined outside specific historical relations. It cannot be imposed upon them and must be drawn from the analysis of the immanent cultural pragmatics themselves. Marcus maintains that there is no special role for the philosopher here. In modernity, the philosopher is no longer the bearer of any special gift for utopia. Neither ancient Sophos nor Enlightenment representative of every man. The contemporary philosopher is no better qualified than any other citizen to offer his or her private opinions as normative visions. What is at stake here is more than a difference of opinion about the dynamics of modern culture. It also insinuates the respective views of the limits of philosophy. It expresses the need referred to at the beginning of the paper for every modern philosopher to find their own equilibrium in balancing the competing claims of the empirical, the normative, and commitment. Heller's own particular resolution reveals one of the most distinctive aspects of her philosophical personality. Readers who are familiar with her work will know a much more traditional view of the role of the contemporary philosopher. For her, normative and existential questions are still essential to the job description. In a characteristic formulation, she suggests, and this is a quote, philosophy wants to shake or shock the readers that they should be dissatisfied with their life rather than grateful for it. So for her, even in the era of increased subjectivism, philosophers are, amongst other things, primarily purveyors of competing rational utopias. This is the reason, at least I think, why she invents the third concept of cultural discourse. Perhaps it is also the reason for her philosophical originality. She chooses not to follow the conventional wisdom of other philosophers, but to take their problems as the basis for thinking through her own solutions. Taking Heller's life work as a whole, it is clear that although today an especially untimely view, this is not likely to worry her in the least. Whether to find her or Marcus's specific reading of the antinomy of modern culture more satisfying, I shall leave up to you. By now, my own preference should be obvious. I find Marcus's historicising perspective more theoretically elegant and empirically compelling. It eliminates the demand for a definitive solution to the antinomies of culture, while still allowing us to theorise a normative dimension within specific cultural relations. The question of whether this will provide a sufficiently critical distance and not fall into the potential of gaining trap of simply expressing the existing modern cultural world is hard to answer abstractly. Theoretically, this would involve the analysis of specific cultural pragmatics. Now, while Heller also gestures to Hegel, her theoretical priority lies with the utopian moment. This produces a certain distance between her normative vision and contemporary cultural dynamics. Even emphatic critique loses potency if it loses contact with prevailing sociocultural dynamics. With this remark, we return to my starting point, but now I will somewhat extend my initial claim. Ultimately, how one weighs competing empirical and normative demands and the arguments that flow from them is not just a question of the existential equilibrium of philosophers, it is a question that all thinking modern individuals must each negotiate for him or herself. Okay. Okay, any questions before Candace falls on me? Any questions?
If there is no one, then I will. First of all, I do thank you very much for your talk, and especially thanks for you elaborating my dear friend George Marcus' concept of culture, from which I learned so much. I think there is in your very visual presentation, there is a little bit of a misunderstanding. Namely, you have not noticed that I change perspectives. And it's also in the flow of the history of fragments. In each chapter, I change perspective. I start to look at the things from a totally different angle. And this happens also in theory of modernity. So when I speak of omnivorous culture, when I speak of the third concept of culture, I do not take the same perspective. I don't think, and this is important, in omnivorous culture, I speak about, this is really empirical, about how the first and the second concept of culture operate in modernity. That is, omnivorous culture takes the second and the first concept of culture via Marcus. We don't speak about the third concept of culture. Basically, what we call nowadays culture, how it operates within contemporary institutions. That's just the first and third concept, but basically providing its problems, that is Romanticism and Classicism or Rationalism, everything is there. But the third concept of culture, I don't think it is normative. I think it's just a different perspective. I don't ask the question, what is the truth about culture? I ask the question, what we discuss as the truth about culture? How do we produce the truth about culture? It's a Nietzschean, a Foucault question. So to repeat with Foucault, Foucault doesn't ask the question, what is a madman, who is not a madman? And does not ask the question, who is mentally sick or not mentally sick? But how the concept of madman, how of the mentally sick is produced? In the third concept of culture, I basically address the question, how we produce the first and the second concept of culture? In which kind of dialogue, which kind of discourse can we come to the idea that there are two concepts, or three concepts of about this culture in general? And this is a meta question. This is not on the same level of the first and second. It's a meta question. How is the concept of culture produced at all? How we produce the culture of Romanticism and Classicism? The conflict between two cultures, Romanticism and Classicism, takes place on the third level. It's a dialogue, in dialogue, that they start to fight with each other. It's not, of course, in both cases, I agree with Marcus. There is an antonymy, the antonymy the other. But in the third concept, I'm not interested in the existence of antonymy. I wanted to speak about the collision of these antonymies, of the dialogue of these antonymies, how it comes into being. And I think when you ask the question, John, who is a cultured man? This is a very simple question. Then you would not refer to a painter. And we do not refer to a cultured man who obeys a rule. Cultured man who discusses matters which are relevant for the concept of culture. This is a cultured man who participates in dialogue. This is utopian, of course, the without interest, etc. This I simply follow Kant's critical judgment here. And I think this is relevant as a normative concept. This is, you are right, these are the normative aspects. But in spite of the normative aspects of it, basically this dialogue is going on. You do it. When we ask the question about such about this concept is right, that concept is right, and it's not just art is discussed, politics is discussed, also in the cultural discourse. Then we do not want to decide something. We do not take sides with something. We do not want to get a conclusion, neither agreement or disagreement, but just talking about because it's pleasurable. We enjoy it when we talk about this question. We feel a pleasure, yes, in a disinterested discussion about things which matter for us. And I think this is really something that's not entirely modern, but almost entirely so. I think Hannah Arendt was right when she said it happened first in Rome. When the Romans returned to the Greeks, they started to discuss Greek poetry, started to discuss Greek philosophy, and this kind of discussion, correspondence with, among Stoics between this. This was already this kind of culture, in the third sense of culture, which is in a really a meta question. How the notions, the concepts of culture are produced? Why do we get pleasure from discussing these things? And of course you said in private content, you are right. That is maybe not private, but in the between private and public. And I think here for me Habermas's concept of Öffentlichkeit makes sense. He speaks about salons, he speaks about cafes, in salons, maybe also in universities, we sit together and passionately discuss that matter of life and death for us, although it has no influence on our life. Whether the concept of culture of Marx is more viable than my concept of that. We look to the same problem. When you discuss this, you are entering this discourse on culture, and which has no influence on your life. So what? What influence has? Are you interested in it? I don't think so. I think you love to think about it and love to exchange ideas with others. This is the simple thing I had in mind. And in spite of its utopian aspect, it is not a utopian concept because we are doing it all the time. We are doing it now. We can do it also in institutional level. We are also doing it now. Because they are hearing all that, they just want to find out what culture is all about. In this case, so they are doing it. And of course, this is a small group. But you are right that we do it in small groups, maybe not in the lead guiding newspapers and not in a professional group. But another thing, and just another thing I want to say, there is a narrowing down. And this narrowing down, I think, in my self-concept, there is one tangible between Markus and myself. Because natural sciences do not belong anymore to culture, to sports, this way. Because you need a professional knowledge in natural sciences, so since this professional knowledge is more and more absent, so in the culture discourse, this culture dialogue, we talk less and less about concrete issues in natural sciences. It fades out. In the 18th-19th century, it was absolutely central to culture discourse. It starts to fade out from our discussion because we believe that we do not have the expertise. And for the culture dialogue, we do not need an expertise. That's not a dialogue of experts. So I'm sorry to talk too long, but I was very much interested and excited about your talk. Thank you.
Well, just to the part of that, I'm afraid I still don't find your reconstruction of your intentions that plausible, and the reason that I don't find it plausible is that on the one hand you accept that the sort of Kantian construction is a normative one, but you're saying, look, beyond that, we're not just talking about norms, because we're talking about actual cultural discussions that are happening in the private sphere amongst friends and across tables and so on. So it's not just normative, you're talking about something that is actual, that's real. But the real question then is, what is the empirical weight of those discussions? Right? Are they empirically significant for contemporary culture or not? Now, what I'm saying is that at least it seems likely that your understanding of culture that is not just normative, but is actual, is being marginalised, right, in the reality of contemporary cultural dynamics. And to me, that makes it, yes, it makes it utopian, and it stresses its normative relation to what's actually happening. So that's why I still think that it is a utopian concept, right? Despite the fact that if you do want to see the utopia actualized, then you do see it, that yes, it exists in conversations, across tables, and amongst friends. But the question is whether that's enough. Will this really be culturally significant, given the other cultural dynamics that are actually operative in the world of omnivorous culture that you're talking about? Now, it's precisely for that reason that I've given the interpretation that I have, and I'm still inclined to back my judgment and say the only way that the concept of cultural discourse makes sense in your whole scheme of things is if you see it as a normative concept that you hope is being actualized, right, in the dynamics of the cultural world, the contemporary cultural world. And what I'm saying is that's a utopian standpoint, and I'm not as convinced by that analysis.
But John, when you said that's a utopian standpoint, you participate in the cultural dialogue with my understanding. Everything what you say about culture, everything what you say about beauty, if we are discussing among us, between us, and there are so many, hundreds of thousands of different us in the world, millions of us, we discuss. Then we say, yeah, this is a beautiful church. And this is what the Corinthian saying. It's a clear universality, because I say this is beautiful, not it is beautiful for me. And this is the same thing in the cultural dialogue. If you say something about who said not something, about what is problematic in the normative concept, it means you take it as truth. That's a universalizing idea. You say it because you believe it is true. You are taking responsibility for this is true. I say, I talk from a different perspective. I tell you what I seek to be true from my perspective. We do not necessarily contradict each other. Although we participate in a dialogue in which not necessarily comes out the result, but the exchange of ideas, the exchange of thoughts itself, in which maintains culture. This is culture. This is cultural evidence that in dialogues, in many dialogues, we maintain this interesting conversation. And I said it's not marginal, because we do it all the time. We do it all the time. Everybody we go to the pub with the students, we do it. Yeah, we do it all the time, we do it everywhere. And that's not marginal. If something which is not officially institutionalized is marginal, that I think it is not the case. Because then making sex is also marginal if it happens outside the family institution. And I think these things are not marginal. It's not marginal because they are not done within the framework of going to speak about the problem of the institution. In the problem of omnivorous and modernity, I spoke about the problem of institutionalized culture. But I take the stand of the non-institutionalized and non-institutionalized culture. That's the dialogue. It's a different position. It's a different, you can say, how institutions are also constituted.
Yes, but look, what I say is, this is the point you're making now, is that, look, I say that the empirical way of sex outside of institutions is far weightier than that of cultural discussion in the sense that you're talking about. So that's my point. My point is, it's a question of the empirical weight of this sort of cultural discourse in terms of contemporary cultural dynamics.
I don't think so. Because in this kind of cultural discourse, we produce mental children. And these mental children, they are disseminated. They're disseminated, everywhere, in fact. They are mediated, disseminated, coming to the mind of others, the mind of others, they are going to institutions, they are going to the debates, they're going everywhere. So these mental children are disseminated. I don't think that they are so important in the cultural discourse. I just, I was the last year in Tehran. In Tehran, there is a dictatorship, you all know that. Yeah? And then the group of people were very freely talking about these matters, about Shakespeare, about beauty, about modernity, about postmodernity. All around the world, we are doing the same thing. Why do you think it's important?
Well, it's really a question of what its impact is. I mean, does it resolve the contradictions of culture? I mean,
but it's not interesting when the contradiction of culture is resolved. That's my problem. Because why should they be resolved? They are rediscussed. They are rediscussed and discussed from different positions. That's enough. Why should they? Why? Life is not a problem which can be solved. Of course, a contradiction cannot be, paradoxes in principle cannot be resolved. But they can be
resolved. But you're obviously talking about real problems. You're talking about commercialization of culture. You're talking about homogenization of culture. These are real problems. And the question then is, does the utopia, right, does cultural discourse sufficiently resolve these problems? And I think no. And I think that shows that it's utopia.
It will not solve the problem, but it's not a matter of problem solving. You are right, it doesn't solve the problem. But maybe you yourself said in this paper that far more people listen to serious music, far more people visit museum than ever before, in spite or perhaps because of the institutionalization. Now, more people can participate in these courses because they go into the museums, everything institutionalized, And then they start to discuss this painting, and they have truth about this painting. So it's not, you yourself made a point about this.
Yes, but that's an argument against, I use that as an argument against the omnivorous culture thesis.
It's not an argument against the omnivorous culture thesis, because omnivorous culture thesis was not a negative thesis. It was descriptive. I haven't meant it negatively. I don't think it's decadent. I think it is...
You haven't meant it negatively. Well, I have got you wrong, because I take the omnivorous culture thesis to be a critical, not just a descriptive, a critical concept.
It is a critical concept, but it does not mean that all philosophical concepts are critical concepts. But if
it I don't think that's true. I mean, no philosophical
concepts. You see, philosophy is about warming, and you can warm and you can... Yeah. You can bring more course of that. But once you take one position, the other time you take the other position.
No. Look, if we're talking about your understanding of philosophy, that's absolutely true. And it's an understanding of philosophy I like. But what I'm saying is that not all philosophical concepts are critical.
Yes, of course, it is a critical conception. But the critical conception does not mean that's an omnivorous critic.
Because, I mean, you understand philosophy in terms of this sort of dialectic between is and ought, and I like that. I think that's for me, crucial to what philosophy should be. But all I'm saying is that not all philosophy is like that.
Can I take that? Okay, yes. I'm just trying to think as you were reading and as you're now talking to Heller about how to formulate a general enough concern or question to gather together some of the rich and different threads. So this is an attempt at that. Maybe it's too general and I'll back up if it's not clear. But it seems to me that in order to juxtapose Heller and Marcus, the position that you're taking, from the authorial background, is a position which wants to know from where authority comes and what cements and extends authority. Namely here, the authority of the cultural critic or of the philosopher, to make claims about whether it's an omnivorous culture or whether it's about the need to justify a particular position of critique in the first place. It seems to me that where Heller gets sold short is in, a not sufficiently maybe a generous stepping back as on the way in which she does juxtapose the notion of the public and the private. It seems to me that, I mean, you can pull out a quote like you pulled out about philosophy's job being to shape up and so on. But I think it's also the case that you could find Heller lauding the Kantian distinction and then Foucault's recovery of the Kantian distinction. She just did it this morning. Of the public and the private, in which publicly my job is to be a critic, but privately I obey. And then what she does is to try to look at that revaluation of values, also again from the other way around. So privately I'm grateful, and privately I have disinterested pleasure, and I'm grateful for my discourses with friends and so on. So the reason that I say I think that she gets sold short on looking at this back and forth between public and private is because what you're calling utopian in Heller seems to be a more creative way of thinking through the power of the normative or the power of the regulative, or we can just say the good ideas, the real empirical power of ideas to affect reality. Because it's the case that in being public and private creatures, we constantly move back and forth in our value creation and reconsideration, so that we can keep setting and positing ideals, the authority to contest something privately, or the strength to obey something and later contest it and so on, comes in through stepping back and forth across these public and private streams, which is where, you know, the power of the regulative comes from. So it's about, in a sense, it's a, you know, it's an logical question. Where does the orientation and thinking come from in the first place? If you don't want to take, you know, this completely value-neutral postmodern position that you're being critical of, you need an orientation and thinking from something. So just to try to wrap it up, it seems to me like you're kind of wearing two hats here. On the one hand, you kind of come out kicking as though you're an old school Marxist, and you want to say, well, yes, because you play like, look, referencing this, you know, philosophy hitherto has only interpreted the world, its job is to change it, look, there are concrete socioeconomic conditions that are going to, you know, hit a person when she's born, and it doesn't matter, you know, what perspectives you teach, they're real, you're going to have to fight against them, and you do this, you know, the heavy lifting of the political economist to say, you know, it's not enough.
I mean, I start with Marx. I need to basically criticize his project of going off the rails and saying, look, his project went off the rails, but the issue that he raised, right, which is the relationship between the empirical and the normative, remains a crucial question.
Yeah. Now, on now, let me just finish my question to you. Then you can I realize why the specter of Marx came up had to do with the importance of philosophy. But the problem with bringing Heller to the story here is what you end up with the favoring the elegance of the Marxist antinomies, is in fact an importance of the philosopher to be anything other than a particularly articulate citizen. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, isn't there something a lot more interesting and exciting about the way in which a philosopher is in fact trained to think about and draw attention to what it means to posit regulative ideals, what you call utopian, what it means to be able to critique them, what it means to be able to teach that kind of thing. I know it's not exactly what you were talking about in your paper, but in making the kind of critique of Agnes as utopian in this way, even one wants to say, if not this, what else? If you're a post-metaphysical thinker, if you're committed completely to relationships of symmetry, politically speaking, you come back to this basically critical idealist position on the status of ideas, and then why be satisfied with the impotence at the end of the day of being happily situated between antinomies? Why not be able to create and set values in this way that you admit at the outset is about being able to learn to move fluidly between the public and the private?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in terms of the general question, what I'm saying is that both philosophers and I think citizens have to make choices about, you know, what standpoint they take up. So, I mean, to that extent, I'm perfectly happy with a postmodern pluralism. What I do say about philosophers is that, yes, philosophers have certain sorts of training, right? And they're training using, you know, they have knowledge, they have skills in sort of conceptual analysis. They have a certain capacity for vision, I think, And that's clearly where pagan Seller comes in, or her interpretation of philosophy. But I don't know that a contemporary philosopher has any more credibility in putting forward a utopia than anyone else. Right? I just don't think that's any longer.
Again, what I'm pushing for here is, why are you even saying you're putting forward a utopia? Why is that even the concept at hand, as opposed to asking about the conditions of possibility for constructing particular kinds of ideals and deconstructing particular kinds of ideals? And isn't it the case that here we have a picture of a crossroads of public and private, where we really learn to cement our authority for crossing from the one to the other?
Well, look, I think, as Agnes said this morning in her talk, she's not saying to me anything that other people have said. I mean, in some sense, she uses Kant to reconstruct in a contemporary setting an understanding of cultural discourse. So, to that extent, right, she's not being incredibly innovative or creative. She's using the cultural materials that are at hand to create something that she thinks is compelling. But I still think the basic point then becomes whether or not this particular vision is as actual as she wants it to be. Now I accept that in general, with her theory of modernity, she wants to say, look, modern dissatisfied society is a society where philosophies come down from the clouds, and it exists in the world, right? Because we are dissatisfied people, and we critique the existing world from the standpoint of our critical values. So, to that extent, philosophy is operative in the world, it's operative in cultural discourse. That's, I think, true. But the point is, how significant that is, right? Is it just a question of private conversations, and to what extent? I mean, how many of these conversations, what is the quality of them, what is their significance? And it's at that level, I think, that what she's talking about, right, there tends to be a gap between that concept, the cultural discourse, and what actually is happening. And so it's for that reason, right, that I'm saying there's a gap here between concept and actuality, and that's my concern.
Yeah, I think the concern is beautifully articulated, but again, here you come out with either the tradition behind you. Philosophy's job is, philosophy hitherto has only interpreted, the job is to change. So where's the beat? Where's the change? Is it really the case that actually you're speaking about something that can deal with authority, with the real world? But then where you retreat back to is a more complacent relaxation between antinomies, as opposed to what it means to be actually, let's say, performatively moving between the perspectives in which you do this kind of...
No. Look, I don't think here that I'm putting any demands on Agnes that Agnes doesn't put on herself. The concept of philosophy that I'm using to judge Agnes is Agnes's concept. Right? She wants philosophy to have a critical role, right, in expressing the world and making some sort of critical intervention into that world. Now, we're not talking about revolutionary change or anything like that, but she wants philosophy to be in some sort of critical dialogue with the world and to act as in her moral philosophy. She wants people to be provided with crutches. She wants philosophy to have a significant social role. So I don't think there I'm applying foreign standards to her at all.
No, I don't mean to say that you're applying foreign standards. I mean to say, in that particular sense, I mean to say, from where is the demand coming for actuality, or from where is the critical perspective that the playing out of regulated ideals in the real world is insufficient here? When someone takes a series of different perspectives, like in the case of the omnivorous culture, which one means critically, but only critically from this particular perspective, why isn't that already a performative instance of what you're looking for, and necessarily critical and actual in the sense? Why is that any less powerful than saying I've chosen two antinomies to stand between, like Freudian's ass?
Well, I'm not saying that's not powerful. I mean, it does operate as a critique of existing culture. One can question how adequate it is and how powerful it is in terms of how well it corresponds to what's actually happening in the culture. Yeah, I'll give you chances. But I think Agnes is wanting to do more than that. And that's my point. I mean, that is, in the sense, her utopian choice. But can we just leave this now and give our friend?
Yes, well, I'd like to add just a bit more about this critical power of philosophy. Mm-hmm. Because I think, like her, that we have to distinguish here two senses of criticism. The Kantian sense as a condition of possibilities and the criterion and all this, and then the critical power of intervening in the world and an applied sense of philosophy. Mm-hmm. But here, I would like to say that it's true that philosophy as a cultural and a human activity is engaged in the world, but at the same time, to grasp the truth of philosophy, it has to be engaged at the same time with itself. And it means that sometimes these applied ethics and these applied philosophies, they are not real, genuinely philosophies. Because it has to be, it's like here the pendulum or the equilibrium is very, it's difficult, but it's precarious. I don't know if the word precarious here.
Yes.
Okay. It's precarious between the engagement in the world, but also the theoretical and the conceptual engagement in philosophy. And here, when you analyze, for example, the theological dynamics of culture, it's not only an empirical question, it's also a reflection of this, a reflection this was what I thought about this debate, but also I would like to say that in your paper, the concept of participation, I found it very interesting. The participation and the tendency, the trend of having your analysis of participation in a culture, because it's not as a Plato like a vertical participation from the things to the ideas and. It's like a hierarchical, it's not hierarchical, it's like in a conversation, it's more, it's not a monologue, so I will... Mm-hmm.